Welcome. I am so pleased to see so many people eager for philosophical discourse and stimulation. We're so glad you're here. It is my delight and pleasure to be able to introduce this evening's speaker, Dr. Scott Davison, who did his graduate work at the University of Notre Dame. Go Irish. His PhD at Notre Dame, and is currently professor of philosophy at Morehead State University in Kentucky. He is the author of several books, including Petitionary Prayer, A Philosophical Investigation with Oxford University Press, and On the Intrinsic Value of Everything with Continuum Press 2012. He serves as the associate editor for Faith in Philosophy, that's the Journal of the Society of Christian Philosophers, and is the book review editor for International Journal for Philosophy of Religion. Tonight he's going to talk to us about some of the puzzles surrounding petitionary prayer. So please join me in welcoming Professor Scott Davison.
Thank you very much. I just realized I left some things in my room that I was going to bring with me, and now I have to improvise a little bit. I've been teaching philosophy for a long time, and I have a dry sense of humor, apparently, and my students don't know sometimes if I'm telling a joke or not, so I've resorted to visual aids to help them. I brought them with me. I brought the cards with me, but I left them in the room across the street, so I have to make them up. Replacements. Okay. Sorry, I just forgot to do this. So if I do make a joke, then I'll flash you the card that says laugh. So you know it's a joke. And if I get off topic or say something that's not funny, then I'll flash you the sorry card. So I just need to have these things in place. I've grown to depend on them. Yeah, I can't speak to a group without having my cards. And I brought them all the way from Kentucky and left them across the street. I'm really, really happy to be back here at Wheaton. It's been a little while since I've been here. I used to come here every year for the annual philosophy conference when I was a graduate student at Notre Dame. And I remember the first time I did that because I was traveling with a professor, a famous professor you've probably heard of, Alvin Plantinga, who was at Notre Dame. And he had this van, and he let some of us ride in the back on the way to Wheaton. And I remember very clearly that experience, because here I am at Notre Dame, I'm with Alvin Plantinga, and I'm riding in his van. You know, how cool is this? Coming to Wheaton College for the conference. And I remember, he's a famous Protestant philosopher, but he was teaching at Notre Dame, which is Catholic, you know. So I was trying to be polite. I said, can I give you some money for gas? I mean, here you are driving me all the way to Chicago and back. And he said, "Oh, that's okay. We'll let the Pope pay for it." That was his joke, but it was so, these are some of the graduate students at that time. This guy I never trusted here, who was a suspicious character. But the rest of them were pretty good. There's some of the faculty in the room here were also graduates of Notre Dame, but they came before I did, so I don't want to make them feel old or embarrassed, so I won't tell you how long ago this picture was taken. Exactly 30 years. All right, so this talk I'm giving now is based on some of the things I discussed in the book that was published not too long ago by Oxford Press, like Jay mentioned. It's a handsomely bound book, and it's affordably priced, and makes a nice addition to any library, public or private. But it would be really inappropriate for me to mention, you know, the publisher's website or the author discount code or on Amazon.com. It would be totally rude to use this as an opportunity to promote myself, so I won't do any of those things. You can relax now. I won't do those things. But I will be talking about what's in this book a little bit. I'm going to talk about some preliminary things before I jump into the arguments. And so let me just lower your expectations appropriately, okay? You're doing pretty well. We need a little calibration. We'll work on that, all right? Okay. I just want to mention some of the people who helped me write this book. Philosophy is a communal enterprise. It's something we do together as a conversation. These are some of the philosophers who helped me write the book. I just want you to understand that. It's not like some one person goes off on a mountain somewhere and comes back with a treatise. You know, we work together with other people. Here are things I won't talk about tonight. I'm not going to try to address. I will not discuss evidence for God's existence from apparently answered prayers. Okay, this is one of the reasons why people care about answered prayers as evidence. I'm not going to really talk about that. It's an interesting question. I won't talk about my own personal prayer practices or my own personal prayer experiences. That's not really why I'm here. I'm one of the last people probably you should ask for advice about how to pray. There's a lot to say here, but I'm not going to say any of it about me. I'm not going to give you advice about how the best you should pray in the petitionary way to ask God for things. I don't have advice like that. I won't disclose the solutions to all the puzzles of petitionary prayer because I don't have them. Some of these are problems that are still with us. I've done my best to try to resolve what I could and clarify the puzzles, but some of the puzzles are just still with us, and maybe they will be with us for a long time. And I think that's okay. It's okay not to know the answer to everything. It's okay to realize that you've done your best and some things are not clear. You know, we can't expect everything to be clear. And for some of us, living a life of faith involves living with doubts, right? And not necessarily resolving those doubts. So I'm not going to try to answer all the puzzles of prayer tonight. And lots of other things I won't talk about. I'll cover that too. Lots of other things. What will I talk about, though? Let me explain this by distinguishing a couple of different roles that I play here as a Christian philosopher. On the one hand, I play the role of a coach. So I'm trying to help people navigate successfully these ideas, right? So that they understand what's happening in their lives and what they should be thinking about and how this works and how the arguments work with each other. But I'm also kind of a referee where I'm supposed to say logically, this is a good argument and this is not a good one. This is a solution to a puzzle, and that's not a solution. You understand? So in my role as philosopher, I'm supposed to say, this is what I think the truth is. In my role as Christian philosopher, I feel sort of like a coach trying to help people navigate these things. So tonight I'm going to be more like the referee than the coach. Okay? So again, I'm trying to frame your expectations here. We're only looking at the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of puzzles and questions and issues here. We can only look at a little bit tonight. I want to talk about why people might pray in the petitionary way in the first place. It turns out there's a number of reasons why people do this. I want to talk about what it means for a prayer to be answered, what that means. It's not totally straightforward the way you might think it is. Are there constraints on God in terms of which prayers God can answer? I think the answer is clearly yes. There are constraints. We'll talk about some of those. And then we'll talk a little bit about Christian teaching concerning prayer and the nature of faith and the nature of trust. Okay? So I always tell my students that, I suppose you know the Baskin Robbins ice cream, right? You know, they always have 31 flavors on hand, right? I always tell my students there are at least 31 flavors of Christianity. And so this is kind of an obstacle for us. I can't just say this is what Christians think because there are all these flavors of Christianity, these different versions and varieties. So we have to be careful when we say this is what the Christian teaching is. Different flavors may not embrace everything we say there. So I'll try to be sensitive to Christian differences here as we go along. Okay? So far, so good? What I said about being a referee and not giving all the answers coincides with one of my favorite philosophers' views on philosophy, Christopher Hamilton. And he basically says, philosophy is not all about solving all the problems and wrapping it up into a nice package. It's about sharing our confusion together and trying to profitably discuss it. So I'm happy to confess to you where I'm confused still about petitionary prayer. And I don't think that means that we've made a mistake or taken a wrong turn or failed to do our jobs as philosophers. Okay? So far, so good? All right, here we go. Now let's talk about what it means to say a prayer has been answered. What does that look like? First thing, I'm going to start with a little story. About 5 years ago, I was camping with my son, Andrew, who was about 12 at the time, up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, the Sylvania Wilderness. It's a very remote place. It takes a very long time to get up there, and it's hours away from any city or town. Okay, so we went up there with some relatives. It was just me and him. I have three kids, but it was just me and him and and some relatives from my wife's family. So I went one day to tell him, he was in his tent, and I said, we're going to go fishing, we'll be back in a little bit. We went out fishing, we came back, and he was gone. He was not in the tent. And so we started looking for him. Like, we went one way on the trail towards the other lake, and we went the other way on the other. And there were people at some of these campsites, and they said, we haven't seen anybody, nobody. And we started shouting. And then there was no answer. He was just gone. And I started thinking, did he drink any water for lunch? Like, could he hear us, but maybe be unable to respond? You know, what could be going on? I mean, there are bears up there, you know. And it started to get dark. He's 12 years old, right? So I was out of things to do. You know, I reached the end. Like, I had nothing. I couldn't sit. I couldn't stand still. I ran out of things to do. I had to pray for his return. And I texted my wife, who was back in Kentucky, hundreds of miles away. And I said, you have to pray for Andrew. He's gone. Like, we can't find him. And then we called 911. They said, we'll come, but it'll take us 2 hours to drive there. And then we have to paddle across the big lake that you've already crossed. And then we have to portage into the other one. And then we get there. By the time we get there, we'll help you look for him. But it's going to be a couple of 3-4 hours before we get there. This is 911. You know, like, no, this can't be happening. I'm watching my life unravel in front of me in a way. So I texted my wife, you got to pray. And then about a half hour later, he just comes walking back from one of these trails. And we said, where were you? And he said, well, I thought maybe you went to another lake. And I said, I told you we were fishing. And he said, no, I didn't hear you. I was asleep. So it was my fault. You know, I thought he said, you know, okay. And so I said, well, where'd you go? I said, well, I went over this place. There were these cool sticks. You know, I was playing with those. And I came back. So he knew where he was the whole time. He wasn't lost in his mind, but for me, I thought he might be. Maybe never see him again, right? So here's a question. Do you think that his safe return was an answer to prayer? I'll ask you to raise your hand if you think the answer is yes, no, or not sure. Do you think it was an answer to prayer? Yes? Anybody say yes? In my classes, I have people with clickers so I can do instant anonymous polling. I wish I could do that. How many of you say, no, it wasn't an answer to prayer. He knew where he was the whole time. Brave souls. Anybody say, I don't know, I'm not sure about this one. That's a tough call. That's the safe answer. I should have forced you to choose yes or no, right? That would have inspired. Okay. Yeah, so this is what we're talking about here. What's required to say that something is an answer to prayer? As opposed to maybe a coincidence. And are there coincidences, right? Does that even make sense? It's very common for people to say, that's God, by the way. Every time I pray for something and it happens, God must have answered my prayer. I'm sure you know people who make this assumption all the time. I prayed for it, it happened, that means God answered my prayer, right? It's very common for people to do this. But should this be a safe assumption? Should we reason in this way? I prayed for it, it happened, therefore God answered my prayer. Now, that's one of the questions that I want to explore with you in some more detail, okay? Now, just to be clear, I want to distinguish three different claims. For instance, there is the claim that in some way God is the cause of all good things, right? The source of all good things. And I'm not suggesting that we should question that claim, okay? There's also the claim that we should always be grateful to God for good things, even if we don't know exactly why they happen. I was so grateful to see my son come around the corner. You know, at that time I didn't really know whether I didn't think about whether the prayer was answered. By the way, I sent my wife a second text. We found him! Don't worry, he's okay! And then I sent her a third text because she never checks her phone. It's a good thing you're not looking at your phone because she would have been in agony like me for the last 2 hours. Because she didn't endure any of that. Anyway, that was supposed to be funny, but more of a sorry joke.
Yes.
I'll tell you more about that later. So I'm not questioning this, but now I do want to ask if this is right. Whether every time you pray for something and it happens that God answers the prayer, okay? So I think we can hold the first two in place and still ask about the third. That's what I'm going to do, okay? All right. There are lots of different varieties of prayer. This is not drawn to scale, by the way. That was a joke. I'll just rely on the card from now on. So, not drawn to scale. You know, there's different kinds of prayer. I'm just kind of going, there are more than these, right? But I want to focus on the petitionary kind. There are lots of other ways of praying, and what I talk about tonight really doesn't apply to them for the most part. Philosophers are interested in the other kinds of prayer, and there's a growing interest in a number of these categories. I think they raise fascinating questions also, but we're focusing here on petition, where you're asking God to do something, okay? I want to talk briefly about what I call the chemistry of petitionary prayer, that is the ingredients that go into make up a petitionary prayer, sort of the pieces or the parts that are there for every petitionary prayer. So for instance, we have the petitioner, there's our petitioner over here, and we have the thing that's requested, which I'll call the object of the prayer, the thing the petitioner is asking God to do. And then there's the act of the petitioner requesting the object. Did you see my clever animation? I didn't get any reaction to that. Okay. There's the prayer going up. So we have these three ingredients, and it's helpful sometimes to distinguish prayers in terms of these three ingredients. Prayers can be general or specific. Thy will be done is a general prayer, right? Bring my son Andrew back to me is a specific prayer, right? So they can be more and less general, more and less specific. Also, prayers can be public or private. When I grew up, until about the age of 11, I was a member of a community of silent Quakers, and our weekly worship was an hour of silence in which people prayed in the same room, but not publicly together. So it was an interesting mix of individual or public or private, really. And you can also have prayers that are for other people or for yourself or for something else. You might pray that something happened in the world that doesn't involve people. These are all possible. And prayers can be individual or they can be corporate. We could all pray together for something, right? I'm going to focus on individual because I think it makes things simpler. But some people have said about my book that he really should have talked about the corporate case because maybe that's more central. And this is one of the 31 flavors of Christianity questions because in different traditions, the corporate plays a more important role than the individual. So there are lots of books that when people review my book, sometimes they tell me about the book that I should have written instead of the book I did write. And I hope somebody writes those books too, because they're all great books that they are talking about. It's just not the book that I could write. So I wrote the book that I could write. All right, so all these things you can see in the case of Andrew, the object, the petitioner, the act of petitioning. Why do people pray in the petitionary way? What's the point of doing that? Why would you pray? Why would you ask God to do something? Well, here is an interesting and important verse from the book of Philippians that you might have heard before. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation by prayer and petition with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. There is the first part of that verse is saying, basically, you should offer petitionary prayers, right? Notice what happens next. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. So what Paul doesn't say is, ask God for something when you're troubled, and God will give it to you. He doesn't say that. Notice, right, he says, the peace of God will guard your hearts and minds. So one of the reasons people might pray is because they think this is at stake. The teaching says to pray the petitionary way. I'm going to trust the teaching. I'm going to pray in the petitionary way. This is what I've been told to do. Also, maybe I'm making myself actively known to God instead of passively known to God. This is something that C.S. Lewis talks about. God knows everything already, but I might reveal myself to God in a way that enhances our relationship. As opposed to him knowing me passively, I might volunteer myself to God. It's a different way of being known by God. Praying is a way of sharing with God what I am thinking about. C.S. Lewis is important on campus. I'll come back to C.S. Lewis later. Obtaining the peace of God, right? So that's what this verse says. Promises the peace of God. Right? If you pray in the petitionary way, the peace of God will guard your hearts and your minds. These are all reasons. And then, of course, there is the possibility of influencing God's action in the world. And what I want to say here is this is not the only point of petitionary prayer. That is, moving God to act somehow. It's not the only point, right? There are other points involved here, too. Clearly, other reasons for praying in the petitionary way. So if I say, It's not clear when we know whether our prayers have been answered. I'm talking only about this last one. I'm not talking about these things at all. These other reasons remain in place, right? But I want to focus on what it means to say that your prayer did influence God's action in the world. So I want to really turn up the magnification on that one, okay? So let's talk about that a little bit more. What does it mean exactly to say that God did answer a prayer? Let's get that clear as we can. There are some complexities here. I mentioned here, this is different. People sometimes say God answers all prayers, but sometimes the answer is no. Have you heard this before? I'm sure you've heard this before. That God answers all prayers, right? Sometimes God's answer is, to a request, the answer is no. This is a complication about terminology that I want to resolve in a certain way before I go on. So what I'm going to say is I'm going to define the word answer in a kind of narrow way. I'm going to say, the way I use the word, I'm going to stipulate that God answers a petitionary prayer only if God actually brings about the thing that was requested in the prayer. Okay? And then I'm going to say God responds or replies to a prayer only if God responds to it, not by answering, but in some other way. Does that make sense? So then in my sense, I would not want to say that God answers all prayers, because sometimes if God is saying no, then that's a response. It's not an answering of the request, in my sense. Can I illustrate this with an example? It's a famous example. You've heard of this, I'm sure. This is St. Paul talks about this in 2 Corinthians. In order to keep me from becoming conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. We don't know what Paul's thorn was. We don't know what he wanted removed. Scholars have all these interesting conjectures about what it might be. I don't know if you know what they are, but they're interesting theories, but we just don't know. But what Paul tells us is that God basically said no. So in my terminology, what this means is that God replied to the prayer, but didn't answer it, didn't grant the request. Okay? This is just terminology. So when I talk about an answer prayer, I mean one in which God did the thing that was requested in response to the request. That's what I want to get clearer about. So far, so good? Okay. Now, for something to count as an answer to a prayer, God must have brought that thing about in part because it was requested in prayer. I want to say that prayer has to play some role in God's decision to do that thing. That means God has to be aware somehow of my prayers before God decides what to do in response to them. Right? When I say before, I have in scare quotes because God might be outside of time. This might not be a sequential ordering. I'll talk about that in just a second. But it seems to me that in order for a prayer to count as answered by God, God must have brought it about in, at least in part because it was requested by prayer. Not just because I requested it, but at least in part. The prayer has to make some kind of difference. Some kind of difference. In order to count as answered. And I'll give another argument for this in just a second. So how is it possible that God could know in advance what I'm going to pray? Well, here I'm going to just mention 3 accounts of divine providence. I'm not going to describe them in any detail. I just want to put them up there for you. Probably you've already heard of all these things. You know, one possibility is that God doesn't actually know the future yet, but God knows all the possibilities. And so when we make free choices about the future, God doesn't know which way we're going to go, but he knows all the possibilities. And so God might be responding on the fly, on this picture, to our petitionary prayers. A different picture has God outside of time altogether, and seeing the entire future laid out in one eternal present moment, and seeing our petitionary prayers, and seeing God's answers also from that point of view of eternity. That's one possibility too. And then there's this view called Molinism, or middle knowledge, after Luis de Molina. And this is a slightly more complicated picture, which says God knows the future in virtue of knowing what would happen in every possible situation that you could be placed in, including your choices. And so God knows where the tree goes in all directions, and if he starts you down one path, he knows where it's going to go. Again, I'm not talking about Providence per se tonight, but I just wanted to throw these different possibilities up because they give you different accounts of how God could take prayers into account when deciding what to do in the world. Okay, so the point of this is there are many flavors of this here. Flavors of providence, right? At least three flavors of providence. So how you explain God's ability to consider prayers and take them into account is going to vary depending on how you think about providence. Okay. Are there constraints on God's action? Are there things that God cannot do? I think we have to say that there are. At least philosophers have thought of this in that way. Did you see the constraints? Those are constraints. The big blue constraint. Not even God can. That was supposed to be. Okay, that's better. Yeah. I have better animations to come, trust me. This is not the highlight. I'll tell you when it's the finale, okay? You'll be like the fireworks, you can tell that'll be the finale. So everybody, I mean not everybody, but almost every person who's a philosopher who's believed in God, a theologian who's thought about this, not everybody. It's the majority view that there are logical limits on God's power. There are things that God can't do because they aren't things that can't be done. You know, God can't draw a square circle on the ground. There's no such thing as a square circle, right? You can't make something like that. It's just impossible. God can't do what's intrinsically bad. Assuming God is essentially morally good, God can't do, even if I ask, even if I beg, God can't do what's intrinsically evil. It's just contrary to God's character, right? God has a plan for the world. What if what I ask for is incompatible with God's plan for the world? What if God's plan for the world is moving on all kinds of fronts and all kinds of details, and I want this one thing to be different? It could be that what I'm asking for, maybe I don't realize it, maybe what I'm asking for is actually incompatible with what God is doing, and that God's already moved things in that direction to such an extent that it's not easy just to flip that piece. You know, that could happen too. So these are all constraints on things in terms of what God can do. So for our prayers to be answered, there has to be some kind of, we might say, space among God's reasons for the prayers to make a difference. There has to be enough room in between God's reasons for doing things in the world that the prayer can be added to the scale somehow to influence God's action in a way that makes some kind of contribution for the prayer to be answered, in my sense, that God is doing it in response to your request. Does that make sense? There has to be space among God's reasons. I talk about this more in the book, but I said I wouldn't promote the book, so I won't do that anymore. Make that go away. Let me say more about what it means to do something in response to something. I've said, in general, you can say, for a request to be answered, the offering of the request has to play an essential role in explaining what happened. Suppose that I ask my neighbor, this is not my neighbor, it's just a picture I got from the internet. This is what happens when you Google, like, trimming hedges. So suppose I ask my neighbor to trim hedges between my house and his house. We don't have hedges, but it's just fictional. You know, just pretend. And suppose that he wasn't thinking about trimming the hedges, but notices that the hedges need trimming and doesn't have anything else to do. And he's on friendly terms with me, and so he decides, because I asked, he will trim the hedges. And he does a fine job, let's suppose. There, his trimming of the hedges is explained by my request. Like, he wouldn't have done it otherwise. You know, it wouldn't have occurred to him that day. So the reason why he trimmed the hedges is because I asked, right? It's not enough that what I request just happens to come to be. It has to come to be in part because I requested it, right? What if my neighbor in case two here, it looks just like case one because it's the same picture. What if my neighbor trimmed the hedges, just like case one, he did trim the hedges, but he trimmed the hedges not because I asked him. In fact, he was going to trim them anyway. And when I asked, he almost decided not to trim them because he doesn't like me today. But for his own reasons, it was on his list, he had 10 reasons to trim the hedges, he goes ahead and trims them. But my request is not plays no role in his decision, right? That could happen instead. And then, should I say that he did this in response to my request? I think the answer is clearly no. If I hadn't said a word, he would have done the very same thing. He had all these reasons to trim the hedges. None of them included my request. And let's suppose he doesn't like the fact that I asked him to do it, and it almost talked him out of it, but he still trimmed them anyway. See, there my request is not explaining why he trimmed the hedges at all, right? Weshyan, Pashya. If I tell you caution, duck, in Chinese, and you're in an airport in China, and somebody, like, I shout that at you, but you don't know Chinese. But I shouted it at you, it makes you very frightened. So you do duck and take cover. Did you duck because I asked you to, because I told you to? You didn't understand a word that I just said. You just happened to do the thing I asked you to do, right? That doesn't count as responding to my request either. So the request has to play a role in explaining why you do what you do for it to count as being answered. Does that make sense? It seems to me that that's right. Okay, so it has to make some kind of difference to God. I'm not saying it has to be the only reason God does something. It has to make some difference. It has to have some, play some role in God's decision to do what God does. Now, why would God wait for a petitionary prayer from me, say, before he provided some good thing, either for me or for you or someone else? Why would God wait on my prayers before doing this, providing something? Here we get into the question of how to defend petitionary prayer and how to challenge it. So some people challenge it by saying, it doesn't make sense that God would wait for my prayers to do something for you. He should just help you out and not wait for me. The problem is, if he doesn't make his provision dependent on the offering of prayers, it's hard to see how the prayers are making a difference and how they're answered when he does make the provision. So this gets into the defenses and challenges, which I'm not going to try to survey here because that's really the bulk of my book. But the question to try to answer is, why would God wait for petitionary prayers? If God doesn't wait for prayers, if he's, and waiting is a bad word because it sounds like it's time, right? Why would God make the provision of good things dependent on the offering of prayers? Why would God let that be the deciding factor, or even one factor, in what's happening when he decides to provide good things? This is the question of trying to explain how petitionary prayer works. It's a little easier to explain prayers for yourself than prayers for other people, I think. It's a little easier to explain how they work because you don't have this question about God not helping somebody else because you didn't ask for them. It's a little easier to explain why God might not help you if you don't ask for yourself. This is a very general comment. There are lots of distinctions to draw here between prayers for self and prayers for others. But in general, it's easier to explain why prayers for yourself would be like this, that God would not provide something unless until you ask for it. Now, I did say before that there were lots of reasons for people to pray in the petitionary way, right? And I want to come back to those reasons, right? So, we've been talking about making a difference in terms of what God does, but that's not the only reason why people pray in the petitionary way. There are still these other ways, other reasons. And you need not have in mind influencing God's action in the world as your principal purpose when you're praying in the petitionary way. So for some people, it doesn't really matter in some sense whether God answers the prayer, but they are going to pray in the petitioner way, and they don't have a problem with that. Let me talk a little bit about the epistemology of answered prayer. I gestured in this direction before, but now I really want to come back to it clearly. Is it possible to know that a prayer has been answered by God? I think what we've said so far should make us a little nervous. So, there are specific cases where we seem to be told that a prayer was answered because it made all the difference in the world. Here's an example from the Hebrew scriptures of Elijah's showdown with the prophets of Baal. I don't know if you know this story. It's a great story, right? Elijah and the prophets of Baal square off, and they say, our God's bigger and stronger than yours. And Elijah says, no, he's not. And they say, well, let's have a contest. You know, let's see whose God can burn up this pile of wood. And so they do a dance, and they try to call their God, and nothing happens. And Elijah says, go ahead and put water on my wood. It's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. And they're like, what? You're crazy. He's like, yeah, no, go ahead. I think he does it three times. And then he prays, and then the fire comes out of heaven and consumes the wood, and all the prophets are embarrassed. Gets worse from there. I wasn't even trying to joke about that. It gets worse from there. So in that case, it looks like, well, we're told that in that case, it looks like it's the prayer of Elijah that makes the difference, right? We're not often in that situation, right? where we know exactly what the cause is, and we can say, this was God doing it because I asked. Do we typically know what God's reasons are for doing what God does? See, I think we should be hesitant here. It might seem to us that what I asked for is exactly what happened, so it must be that God did it because I asked, at least in part. But it's hard to know in particular cases if that's true. If we're not in a prophets of Baal situation, it's hard to know. It's even hard to know what God is doing and not just permitting. It's hard to know. Let me just give you an example of this. So, okay, this is the best animation. Okay, I'll just tell you. This is going to be it, okay? It's all downhill from here, right? So, all right, we have a sick person. There's a sick person. And then we have, of course, God is up there. We have the supplicant, the petitioner, praying the petitioner in prayer for the healing of the sick person. And then, let's suppose God does act and heals the person. There's much rejoicing on both parties. Okay, so now, above this line here, let's suppose, is the part that you don't see, right? Right? So you see the person offer the prayer, or you see the person healed, but do you know that the prayer, do you know that the prayer made the difference? Even if God did the healing, are you sure that it was the prayer and not some other reason that God had for doing this at this time, in this situation, healing that person? You see my problem? It's a puzzle, right? Of course, God's ways are not our ways. God knows a lot more about the world than we do. That's an understatement. A lot more about the world. God knows the long-term plan. God knows where things are going. We don't really know these things, right? So for us, with our limited perspective, we see a pattern. This fits perfectly what I expected after I prayed. That doesn't mean that that's the full story about what's happening in the world, right? God's perspective might be quite more complicated than that. Here's an argument that seems attractive at first, but I'm going to suggest it probably has a mistake. The argument goes like this. Sometimes we don't know why God brings about particular things. I don't know how you could argue with this. This seems pretty straightforward, that premise. So sometimes we don't know whether the offering of a petitionary prayer played a significant role among God's reasons for bringing about some particular event. But then, if the offering of a petitionary prayer doesn't play a role, a significant role, among God's reasons regarding some event, then the petitionary prayer was not answered. It would be like a coincidence that the prayer was offered and the thing, God did it for other reasons. So then sometimes we don't know whether the petitionary prayers were answered, even if the things requested do come to pass. This seems like a fairly good argument. I do think it might suffer from a logical problem. The logical problem is the assumption that the conditions of knowing something have to be in place and known for you to know the thing. So let me come back to this argument in just a second, but let me give you an argument that I think illustrates the flaw that animation's out of order. I can't fix that now. There's Superman and Clark Kent. Here's the principle that I'm going to question, and this is what philosophers call the closure of knowledge under implication. I'm missing a parenthesis there. That's a bad mistake. I used to be a copy editor. It's embarrassing. So if some proposition P implies a proposition Q, and we don't know that Q is true, then we don't know that P is true. That's a principle that I think philosophers have shown to be false, but I think it might be playing a role in the argument I just gave you. Here's a counterexample. Suppose it's true that Clark Kent is in the room, and if Clark Kent is in the room, then this implies that Superman is in the room, because Clark Kent is Superman. But suppose that we don't know that Superman is in the room, because we don't know that Clark Kent is Superman. All we know is Clark is here, but we don't know that that's who Superman is. Well then, does it follow that we don't know that Clark Kent is in the room? No, we know Clark is in the room. We just don't know Superman's in the room, right? So this is a bad argument. You see the argument? This principle is not true. Philosophers sometimes qualify it. They say, well, then what you need to say is if P implies Q, and we don't know that Q, and we know that P implies Q, then we don't know that P. Closure under known implication, that's a different principle. But I don't think that's the one that's at work in the argument that I was talking about. There it was here. I'll get it back up there. So I think that this argument might have that flaw. But there is a lingering worry, even if it's a bad argument, There's a lingering worry that if we don't know God's reasons for things, we really might be in the dark about why things happen, and so we might really never know in specific cases with any confidence whether what we've asked for was actually answered by God as opposed to happening for other reasons. The picture over there is a picture of Job. That's a photograph of Job in the middle of the tribulations, captured at just the right moment. Time magazine picture of the year. Job saying, "What? Why have these terrible things happened to me?" You know, if you read the book of Job, there's a great, poetically great, obviously horrible. You know, he gets these reports one after another. And while he was yet speaking, somebody else came and said, "Oh, your kids are all dead." And while he was speaking, "Oh, your animals are stolen." Oh, it gets worse and worse, right? While he was yet speaking, somebody else came. And then that's the face he has. So the thing about the book of Job, if you read the answer from God in the whirlwind, you know, the Job has his speeches, and his friends have the speeches, and God has his speeches. One of the focal points of God's speeches to Job is kind of like, you know, there's all this stuff going on in the world that I'm doing that you don't know about with all these other creatures, you know, and it's really complicated, and you didn't make it, and you don't know how it works, and, you know, you're probably barking up the wrong tree here, right? I'm paraphrasing. Not exactly what it says. But, you know, when you read that, it just makes you, it gives you pause, right? So Job and his friends think that they have all the relevant facts about the case in front of them. And that God is kind of saying, you don't really have all the relevant facts to judge what's happened here, right? Most crucially, Job is never told about the wager between God and Satan about whether Job would pass the test, right? So for us, watching from the outside, we're like, he's never told. If he were told, of course, it wouldn't be a good lesson for us, because we never know what's going on when we suffer, right? So when you think about this, I think you might think that the conclusion might be true, and if the argument is bad, there might be a better argument. It's hard. I'll just say this much. I think there's a lot to say here, but I can't say it tonight. The epistemology of answered prayer is very tricky. And it's very hard to find an epistemology that's plausible, that yields the result that we often know that prayers have been answered. But you might say, what about the Christian teaching about petitioning prayer? Maybe that'll help us here. I do want to talk about that. I want to remind you, though, about what I'm questioning and what I'm not questioning, right? So I just want to repeat this slide, right? I'm not saying we should question whether God is the cause of all good things or that we should always be grateful. It's just that it's not clear that every time I pray for something and it happens, God answers my prayer. It's just not clear that seems like it's probably not warranted, right? When I say every time. Okay, so now I want to add a little bit of psychology that we should throw into the mix here, and it should make us even a little more suspicious of our tendency to assume that our prayers have been answered when the things we requested actually happen. There's a really interesting book, you might have heard about this. T.M. Moorman is an anthropologist who spent a couple of years with different Christian communities. She's not herself a Christian, but she wanted to see how people learn to interpret and understand the world through prayer and as an expression of God's will. So she immersed herself in these sort of non-traditional Christian communities. I think they were sort of like vineyard churches in two different places. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. So she gives an explanation in terms of psychological processes and ways of perceiving the world that explains why people were able to see the world as an answer to prayer, able to see things as expressions of God's will, how they were sort of trained by this community to perceive the world in this way. And so it's a really fascinating study. But what it suggests when you read it is like, yeah, I guess I could be influenced in the same way to see things as answers to prayer, even if they may not be answers to prayer, you know? So it gives you pause. It makes you wonder. And of course, we know from psychology that I don't have to persuade you of any of these things, but we know that we tend to assume that we're at the center of things, right? I have three kids. I can see it in them. It doesn't go away when you get older. Yeah. We need calibration. We need to work on this. Yeah, that's better. Okay, I guess I apologize for that one. All right, so, now we do tend to assume that we're in the middle of things. We assume that when something happens, it's because we caused it, and maybe that gives us some kind of adaptive advantage moving through the world. Maybe it gives us, makes us more likely to find causal connections and navigate successfully, but we tend to assume we are in the middle. We look for patterns all the time, but that's the kind of creatures we are. We try to see causal explanations. Whenever something happens, we want to know why. And we will frame a theory. You know, we are explanation creators. That's what we do. We have narratives that explain, and we appeal to things we know and control to understand things we don't know or control. It's just how we move through the world. We need a story. We need a story. We tend to assume that what we do makes a difference. You ever been in out with friends, and somebody's very unhappy, and you say, "What did I do? What did I say?" And the person says, "It had nothing to do with you, right?" But you feel responsible. It's the first thing. Somebody honks a horn. Did I do that? What did I do? If you're driving, we just do have this tendency. And that plays into the tendency to see everything as an answer to prayer, even if it's not. As we said in connection with the book of Job, the world is big and interconnected and complicated. And we don't represent the world in all that detail. We're not really able to. So you might think of it as a kind of temptation to see everything that happens that you pray for as an answer to prayer. It might be actually a temptation to see things that way because you're not sure that they are. Yeah. All right, let's talk about Christian teaching because this is important for us to consider also. And again, this is the tip of the iceberg thing, so we're not going to be able to get into this very much. We've already pointed out there are lots of different kinds of prayers, right? Prayers of thanks, prayers of praise, prayers of confession, and so on. It's not true that every time you're commanded to pray, you're commanded to pray in the petitionary way. Paul says in Thessalonians, pray without ceasing. But he doesn't say how, which one, which type, right? He doesn't say pray in the petitionary way without ceasing, right? He doesn't say that. So it's not clear, right? Praying without ceasing could mean a lot of different things. And, of course, not every reason that we give for praying in the petitionary way requires the assumption that God will answer all of those prayers. We just looked at four other reasons why people should pray in the petitionary way or might pray in the petitionary way, even if they don't know whether God is going to answer them. In my sense of answer, which is to do the thing that's requested, there's the scripture we looked at in connection with that set of reasons. I'll just remind you of that scripture there. We're not really told that every prayer will be answered. Even if every prayer does receive some reply or other, this goes back to that terminology. Maybe every prayer gets a reply. We're not really taught in the scriptures that every prayer will be answered in my sense, that God's going to do everything you ask, right? We're not really told that, right? We saw the example of St. Paul, who asked to have the thorn removed from his flesh, and he's told no. Now, let's talk about a puzzle from C.S. Lewis. This is based on his reading of the Gospels. Like I said, C.S. Lewis is an important person here on campus. We have the letters from C.S. Lewis. We have the wardrobe. And you know, did you see what I did there? I put him in with the... That was a little weak joke, you know. Okay, I'm sorry. I defended half of you. Now, that was supposed to be funny. For some people, Lewis does have a kind of, you know, magical status. I think Lewis is great and really important. And that was supposed to be funny. So apparently, I've just worn out my welcome. So I'll be leaving tomorrow. So here's a puzzle. He writes a letter to his local clergy. I don't know if you've heard about this. He wants to know how to pray. And he asks his local clergy, and he says, "Now, I've got a problem here. I've got a puzzle. Because there seem to be two ways that Gospels, Jesus is teaching us how to pray." And he says, "I'm going to call the A pattern and the B pattern." Has anybody read this before? Do you know what I'm talking about, the C.S. Lewis piece? Okay, I see one or two people who have seen this. So the first pattern is a kind of prayer where you see Jesus, he models this himself, right? He says, in the Garden of Gethsemane, "May this cup pass from me, but thy will be done." And so the point of the prayer is that it asks for something, but then it's It's also followed by, "Thy will be done." And that's kind of the overriding piece of the prayer. It's kind of like, but, you know, whatever you think is best, I want you to do that thing, right? So there's a kind of backing away from the object of the prayer, right? But then there's this B pattern. And you see this especially in Mark, but also in Matthew. And here's an example. I think this is from Matthew, yes. "Truly I tell you, if you have faith and do not doubt, not only can you do what was done to the fig tree," remember he cursed the fig tree, you know, withered that part away, "but also you can say to this mountain, go, throw yourself into the sea, and it will be done. If you believe, you will receive whatever you ask for in prayer." And so Lewis says, this pattern, this teaching, suggests that I need to have, like, confidence and ask for something, and if I have faith, it will be answered. Not just replied, but answered. And Lewis says, how do I put these two teachings together? How am I supposed to pray? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to say, I want this, and I have faith and confidence that it's going to happen? Or should I say, well, thy will be done? He says, I don't see psychologically how I can put those two attitudes together in the same space at the same time. I can pray this way, or I can pray that way, but I can't do them both. And as far as I know, he never got an answer to this letter. Because it's a good puzzle. Lewis does consider a possible solution to the problem of trying to pray in the same way, in both ways at the same time. His way of describing the problem, like I said, is that the B pattern requires a kind of faith that he says, I don't have that. Like, I can't tell the mountain to go and throw itself into the sea. Like, I just don't have that faith. Like, I can't say that. And he supposes maybe that kind of faith would only come as a result of some kind of gift from God. But then he says, am I supposed to ask for it? But which way am I supposed to ask for it? In the confident way or the thy will be done way? It's just kind of, I don't know what to do here. I'm stuck. How should I pray tonight? He says. Now here is a way of trying to resolve this. You might say, wait a minute, I think I can see how these fit together. And Lewis considers a possibility. He says, well, maybe what's going on is that every time you have the B pattern, which is the one where you demand something particular, maybe not demand is not a good word, where you request something specific with faith that it will come, maybe that really involves some kind of implicit thy will be done clause, right? So, mountain, throw yourself into the sea, I have faith, but thy will be done. Right? Lewis says, I don't think that's going to work. What would you say to a person who did pray in that B pattern way and then it didn't happen? Would you say you didn't have enough faith? You didn't really have faith? It's your fault? He's got an interesting example here. Dare we say that when God promises, you shall have what you ask, that he secretly means, well, you shall have it if you ask for something that I already wish to give you? That can't be what the teaching means. What would we think of an earthly father who promised to give his son whatever he chose for his birthday, and then when the boy asked for a bicycle, he gave him an arithmetic book? And then he first disclosed that the silent reservation with which the promise was made was, I'll give you whatever you ask for as long as you ask for something I already want to give you. We would say, that's not a good father. He would say, Lewis actually says that's a, he's got a nasty word for the father, I can't remember what it is. So Lewis doesn't like the solution that there's an implicit thy will be done built into every prayer. He doesn't think it fits with the teaching about the strong form of faith. And he's stuck. He says, help me, how do I pray tonight? And it's a good problem. I'm not sure how to answer it. I still struggle with it. This is one of those puzzles I don't have the resolution to. It's especially interesting in the book of Mark because faith there seems to be a kind of tenacity in pursuit of Jesus. There are several great stories in Mark where Jesus attributes healing to somebody's faith. There's the woman who had 12 years with the hemorrhage, and the outer story in which that one is contained is the Jairus, whose daughter is 12 years old, both 12, right? And on his way to heal Jairus' daughter, he's interrupted by the woman who has the hemorrhage for 12 years, and then he says, who touched me? And then the disciples say, you're kidding, everybody's touching you, who knows? And she confesses, and of course she's touched him, and she's unclean, so this is a risky thing to disclose, and you're asking, how could she have the courage to touch him and then tell him that she touched him? You know? And so he says, your faith has made you well. He doesn't say God healed you because you asked for God to heal you. He says, your faith has made you well. So there you get this idea that faith itself is some kind of force that makes things happen in the Gospel of Mark. Same thing with Jairus' daughter. So, I don't know. It's a good interpretive puzzle. It's a theological question. It's really kind of out of my area. So it's a puzzle. So I don't have the answers to all the puzzles. Okay. So now let me just talk briefly about faith here, and I'll finish off. There are different things that people say that faith could be, and this has actually become a hot topic in philosophy right now, whether faith involves belief or not. Here's a picture from my book that illustrates the relationship between trust, or you might say risk, and evidence or confidence. So if you look at this picture, the dark area here is supposed to be the degree of trust. So this is a lot of trust here, and then it tapers off toward the right in this picture. This lighter gray area is supposed to be your degree of evidence. So here, if you have 100% evidence, you're absolutely certain. Here, you have no evidence at all. If you get 100% evidence, which is proof, trust is no longer possible. You run out of that trust. There's no trust there. If you know absolutely what's going to happen, you're not trusting. There's no room for you to trust. But if you come the other way, if you have a lot of trust, but you have zero evidence for what might happen, you might have what we call blind trust. Like, you're trusting without any reason at all, you know? You're taking the maximal risk, you might say. Let me just say how this might go with faith and trust then. If I get my neighbor to cut the hedges, I'm not trusting very much because he's very skilled at this, you know? So I might be said to have this combination. Like, there's a little bit of trust there, but mostly I've got such good evidence that he's good at this, I really don't trust much, right? If I ask my daughter to take care of the rabbits while I'm out of town, let's see what she's doing here. There's a little more trust involved. She's good, don't get me wrong. She's very good, but she's in school all day. She might forget, you know what I mean? Like, there's a little bit of risk, a little more risk involved. She's 13 now. But when this was taken, she was like 10. So a little more trust. And then if you imagine a different case, this is my son when he got his driver's permit. I probably don't have to say anymore about that. There's a lot more trust involved there because he doesn't have any experience. He's not very good. Yeah. So there's a lot of trust. Right? How does this work with faith and prayer? I think I need to move a little closer. I'm testing the battery limits over here. Well, even if you don't know that your prayers have been answered, you still trust that God hears your prayers and cares about you, right? That's part of what it means to have faith. Faith in God does involve trusting God, even when things don't go well, even when things don't go the way you asked them to go, or you hoped they would go, or you thought that they needed to go, right? And even if you can't tell whether your prayers have been answered, faith in God calls you to trust God in that situation. Right? Even if you don't have proof that God is going to make things work out well for you in the end, faith involves trusting in God in that situation. It's even possible for some people that it could be an expression of faith not to ask God to do specific things. It could be that the prayer, "Thy will be done," expresses faith in God without trying to get some particular thing out of God in this situation. It could be that not asking God to do things is a way of trusting God. And that sounds paradoxical, we think. Well, it's an expression of faith to pray to God, right? But maybe sometimes petitionary prayer reflects more of an anxiety and a desire to control a situation. Maybe "Thy will be done" is better sometimes for some people. It's possible. So the relationship between petitionary prayer and faith is kind of complicated, I think. I'm going to finish with a story here. About 3 years ago, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had to undergo multiple surgeries and chemotherapy and drug therapies, and now she's better. So her odds of getting breast cancer today are just slightly worse than they were before we knew she had any cancer at all. But during this period, this is me holding on to what's dear to me at that time. During this period, we had lots of people trying to help us. And so we had friends who were believers, not just Christians, but believers, who were praying for us and praying for her health and healing, right? Praying in the petitionary way, very specifically, that treatments would work and blood could be drawn and stuff like that, you know? They were really praying for us. But then we also had a bunch of other friends who were not religious at all. But they were also doing everything they could. They were bringing us food. They were saying, we're sending positive energy your way. You know, they couldn't do thoughts and prayers. They could only do thoughts. I just made that one up. That was. I thought it was OK. It wasn't supposed to be political at all. I just thought it was funny. Thoughts and no prayers. Yeah, they had thoughts and no prayers. They had positive energy. And so, did the positive energy make a difference? Did their thoughts make a difference? Did my wife get better because of the positive energy? Did she get better because of the prayers? We don't know. We don't have any idea, really. But we were really grateful for the support we got from all sides, right? We just don't know all the levers of the universe that were moving at that time. We don't know. We're still grateful. It was a good thing that she's better. We're grateful to God, and we are, doing the best we can to move forward, you know? So sometimes that's the best you can do. You say, I don't know. I can't guarantee that a prayer was answered in this case. Maybe it was. But I'm grateful for her recovery, even if it wasn't answered. Maybe God had reasons to heal her that had nothing to do with my prayers, right? So these are some of the puzzles of prayer. You might have more things to say about this now that I'm finished, but I really appreciate your patient attention and your obedience to my visual aids. So thank you.
We've got a good chunk of time available for questions and answers. And just if you want to pose a question or make a comment to our speaker, just raise your hand and I will acknowledge you, and we'll take it from there. Yes?
Thanks very much, Dr. Davison. This was really interesting. I had a question about something you said like pretty early on, so I'm not sure I'll remember the exact words that you used. But I think what you said is that for a prayer to be answered, a petitionary prayer, it has to play an essential role in God's bringing about whatever is being prayed for. And I wondered if you could say more about that. I'm pretty confused about what causation means and explanation means to begin with, and particularly when it comes to God. But when you say that God does something because I prayed for it, and that my prayer played an essential role in God's deciding to bring it about.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, that's really complicated to try to answer quickly. I spent a lot of pages trying to identify the relevant sense. I don't think I said essential today, but I do say something like that in the book. It was something, but I think the basic idea, not everybody accepts this, is that if the prayer makes no difference at all, if God would have done exactly the same things for the same reasons had you not prayed, then I want to say the prayer didn't make a difference. The question is then explaining in what sense the prayer has to play some important role in God's reasons for doing what God does. And so I take it that's one of the hardest things to try to explain in terms of what petitionary prayer, how it works. And so I tried to give a theory of this in the book, and then some of the reviewers have picked at that and suggested alternatives. And I really hope that there's a lot of work done in that direction, and that gets cleared up. I took a shot at it, and my theory is kind of complicated. It involves contrastive explanations, why one thing happens rather than another. And I think that the right thing to say is that the offering of the prayer plays an essential role in every true contrastive explanation about why God does what God does, but there could be more than one of those true explanations. Mm-hmm. And so it gets quickly technical and complicated. So I can't easily answer the question, but I just want to say it's just hard to answer it, and I'm not confident that I got the right answer either. So what I do feel strongly about, it seems to me, is that it has to, the offering of prayer has to play some role in explaining why God does what God does, or else it's just a coincidence that you offered a prayer and God did this thing, if everything, including God's reasons, would have been the same without the prayer. I'm not sure if that really helps. I think it's confusing.
If I read the book, I'll
yeah. I've got an author discount code here. Thank you.
Yes.
As a follow-up to that question, this side of heaven, and arguably the other side of heaven as well, we will probably never, I would guess, or maybe not.
Yeah.
Did you say that we will ever know really if our prayer played a 0.001%?
Yeah.
Going to God, 100%.
Yeah.
Is there any ways to ever really know for sure, say definitively, God answered this prayer, God did not answer this prayer based on your definition?
Right, right. So it looks like we're told that God answered Elijah's prayer with the prophets of Baal, right? So we're comfortable and confident in that case. But in my own life, will I ever have that kind of confidence? Will I know in the next life everything that happened in this one? Will I understand it perfectly, I think that's a really good and hard question, because we tend to assume that we will understand everything that's happening in this life and the next one. We tend to assume that. But what if that turns out to be, for some reason, either impossible for us because it's too complicated, or maybe bad for us? Do we assume that in heaven we don't need faith anymore? This is a really good question about heaven, right? Is the point of heaven to clear up our uncertainties about this life? Maybe it's not. Maybe it's to draw us into a deeper direction, And maybe we need to let go of these questions about this life. I don't really know how to answer that question. I wish I did. I mean, it seems certainly possible that in the next life, God would say, oh yeah, here's a list of your 25 petitionary prayers that you made during your entire life, and I answered these 12 and not those 13. Yeah, that could happen, I suppose, right? I mean, I don't see why, in principle, it's impossible, but I don't have a guarantee that that's waiting either.
Yes, way in the back.
Abraham's case, I'm talking about, receiving Isaac.
Yes.
Did he pray to receive Isaac that he got it, or put it to Genesis, actually it was not?
Right, just promised.
Right,
yeah.
But in Hebrews, and he
lost. Oh, yeah.
In Hebrews, actually, he received Isaac by faith.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, he said, at the beginning,
right,
that was his prayer.
Yeah.
At the beginning of his life, he asked for a son to be given. And there is evidence, right?
From Genesis or from Hebrews?
No, from Genesis.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah.
Later, actually, he didn't really believe that the son
was coming.
Was coming.
Right. Yes, that's right. Yes.
There is an, I don't think so.
Yes, too old. Yes, right.
So in that.
Right.
What do you think about that?
That's a great point. That's right. So on the one hand, Abraham is a hero of faith, but on the other hand, in the story, he doubts that he will receive Isaac. Right? He doubts. Does his prayer count as an answer prayer? Is that's what you're asking?
Right.
Yeah. This raises all kinds of good questions about the relationship between the New Testament writers and the original Hebrew text, too, right? Some of the things in Hebrews are interesting that way. That's a good question for somebody who's a scripture scholar. But I'm not a scripture scholar, I think it's a really good question. I don't know how to answer it. I'd have to go back and look at the stories again. But I think it's a really interesting, I never thought about it. There's a puzzle here, because Abraham's faith that Isaac will come does waver. Right? Yeah. Yeah, I wish I had a better answer. I'm sorry.
Yes, right over here.
I was thinking, petitionary prayer could possibly be not just influencing God's role in our world, but allowing ourselves to place trust in God and making it better for us, in that we're not stressing about
right.
whatever it is we're praying for, instead of placing
Yes.
Would you?
Yes, that seems totally right. So some people say the point of petitionary prayer, maybe prayer in general, is not to change God, but to change us. Mm-hmm. And that makes total sense, and there's, I haven't said anything to contradict that. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yes.
First of all, but I was just wondering, I feel like there's like a assumption underlying some of this that there would be something harmful in me believing that my prayer was answered, or even responded to, and I'm just wondering if you could vocalize kind of what would be the harm, what's the cash out, and understand why some of my prayers aren't actually answered, even if I might believe them.
Yeah, so this goes back to the philosopher as referee problem. So when I'm serving in my referee capacity, one of my judgments is sort of like, is this assumption rationally warranted? So I don't see any harmful side effects or anything like that. It's sort of from the pure point of rationality, like, do we have good reason to assume that in a specific case, when something happens that I requested, that it was an answer prayer? And I think it just depends a lot on the details of the case. And so there, I'm just saying, not really that there's a harm, just that it may not be completely rational to draw that conclusion for some people in some cases. That's really all I want to say. So, but sometimes, actually often, the best strategy for human beings is not the most rational one. And so it could even be that it's better to believe or assume that an answer isn't, what looks like an answer is an answer, even if you don't know that it's an answer. So the assumption that you're feeling, the worry, the caution, is sort of from the pure philosopher's point of view. It's not like a practical worry that you're going to fall into some false belief or something like that that's going to harm you. I like that question, though.
If I'm understanding it correctly, your thesis is somewhat agnostic about whether we can know whether God responds to prayer. What would you think of the more extreme version of your thesis, that God's immutability precludes the ability to respond to prayer because a response would involve some kind of modification of God's behavior?
Yeah, so that's one of the challenges to petitionary prayer that has a long and distinguished history. And I do talk a little bit about it in the book. Not every flavor of Christianity is committed to immutability. If you are, I do think you might have to think of answered prayers as not so much originating in the petitioner, but really originating in God. So God might be the one who moves people to pray and then responds, but God would be the mover of things. So you'd have to have a different explanation of the dynamic there. And that's perfectly possible. You can see an explanation like that actually in St. Thomas and certainly in Calvin. So this is one of those options that you could go down that road, and you would just, other things would have to change along the way. But I think if you're committed to immutability, you'll have to say something quite different about what it means to have an answer prayer. Like you said, it wouldn't be a response because God doesn't respond literally to anything in that way of thinking about it. Yeah, right.
Yes, Nick.
So a question about different flavors of Christianity. Have you thought at all how this changes if you believe in prayer to the saints?
Yeah,
how to conceive your prayer going to a saint and then the saint's prayer is going to God, or however complex the theological system works.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. So, the flavors are going to have different mechanisms and added wrinkles. And so that's an added wrinkle there. Getting the saints to respond to your prayers or to pray for you would be a lot closer to getting my neighbor to trim the hedges, because I'm dealing with another agent and reasons that I understand. So I don't have the complications until I get to the next stage when the saints pray to God and then God answers their prayer, and then I'm back where I started. So I do think that's an interesting wrinkle. Interesting.
Yeah, Bob. So I want to explore the idea that there are instances where you can know that a prayer has been answered.
Yeah.
I mean, so would you agree first that there are some cases that provide justification for the belief that the prayer has been answered?
I think justification is pretty easy to get. So I'm not really worried about that. So I think justification is kind of easy. Knowledge is a lot harder.
Okay.
So I wrestle with this a lot in the book, and
Can you explain that distinction?
Yeah, so to be justified in believing something means like it's reasonable for you, you have some reason to believe it, and you think the other things you believe support it, maybe. But to know it, it has to be true, and you have to be in the right kind of relationship to it. And that's hard to specify what that relationship is. So I tend to be a person who doesn't, I don't assume that in order to know something, you have to be aware of what your grounds are for that belief. So I'm an externalist in that sense, epistemically. But even when you go down that path, which makes knowing a lot easier, I still think it's not clear in these cases that the alternative possibilities line up in typical cases the way they need to for it to be favorable for us to know. So I kind of want to split the question. I think justification is easy, and we have that a lot.
Would you say the same thing about miracles? So simply knowing that an event is a miracle?
I probably would. Yeah, I probably would say I'm not sure if it's a miracle. Yeah. I would also say that something doesn't have to be a miracle to be an answer to prayer.
Oh, no.
Right? So if God sees from eternity that you're going to ask for something, like my son's return, it could be perfectly natural explanation why he comes back. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right?
So I'm just trying to explore the idea that if you're willing to admit that you can know that an event is a miracle.
Yeah.
And it seems pretty straightforward that knowing that miracle was an answer to prayer would also come with that if those circumstances were such that you pray for the miracle and the miracle took place. You know it's a miracle, so then you know that this is something that God has done.
Well,
but can you know then?
I would still be hesitant because God might do that miracle for other reasons, right? Yeah, so I need to know that my request plays some role in the miracle's production somehow. And that'd be back to my reasons problem. Yeah.
Yes, right here.
So I know you said a minute ago that you're not a biblical scholar. I was just wondering if in your book do you explore the biblical teachings on prayer and how the biblical authors talk about its power and its necessity as opposed to just the philosophical thoughts on it?
A little bit. I'm not sure how much further I go into it than I already did here. Like a few verses here and there, I talk about the C.S. Lewis puzzle a little bit. I'm hesitant to wade into the scriptural stuff because I'm not trained that way to handle those things properly. It's really people have a lot of different interpretations of those scriptures, right? And how to put them together. And to say that there's a single teaching about prayer, of course, would be misleading, because there's a lot of teachings from a lot of books and a lot of different figures, right? And so to try to put that together is really a challenge for a theologian. Like I said, that'd be a great book if I could write it. I wish I could write it, but I'm not really trained to do that. So in the book, you wouldn't get very much more of the scriptural stuff than you've got tonight, so that should not be a reason to buy the book. A joke. You should buy the book anyway. It's just too expensive. It's really too expensive. I was really joking at the beginning. It's too expensive. Get a used. No, go to Amazon. No, I didn't say that. Don't. It's prohibitively expensive, I think.
Yes?
So if one were to go down the path of only praying with thy will be done.
Yeah.
For various theological reasons.
Right.
Would you say, in that case, you're missing out on some sort of foundational benefit from petitionary prayer?
Can you say more? Like?
So part of the reasons you listed involves making yourself actively known to God, acquiring the peace of God.
Yeah.
In what way does petitionary prayer accomplish this?
I see.
A thy will be done prayer.
I see. Good. So if you only say thy will be done, but you don't say, here's why I'm saying thy will be done. Like, you're not saying, here's what I'm worried about. You know, if Jesus my fears, this is why I'm saying thy will be done. You get that thy will be done after a process of struggling, right? Like, I'm really worried about this. When I get to thy will be done, I'm sort of like, but I'm going to accept what happens, right? You know, so I think
it might be a mistake always just to say, thy will be done. If you sort of have this idea that you should be making yourself known to God actively and not just passively, right? So there's a reason for saying, thy will be done. And that needs to be shared with God also before you get to thy will be done. Does that make any sense?
So essentially, if you just process everything internally and then say, thy will be done, and that's your only communication, that's where the problem is?
Well, it seems like that's, I'm just trying to track the argument you're giving, which is that one of the benefits is that one of the benefits wouldn't be there if you just said, thy will be done. Is that,
yeah.
Is that fair?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, I just imagine there would be a lot to say before you get to that place. But I'm the wrong person to be asking for advice about this. You know what I mean? So you might have somebody else in mind too here. Did you have another response to that? Are you thinking there, this goes on further, it gets worse if you just say by the
well, I was thinking along the lines of if you believe in predestination,
yeah,
and that God has a set plan for everything that happens,
yes,
what are the implications for that if you should step back and just say that will be done because in that case you believe nothing you say can change it. So I guess I'm looking more at labels for Christianity.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So I really should be praying for things, particular things, because God has ordained it. That those prayers should be answered as part of this plan for the world. If I step back and I stop praying for specific things, then I'm not playing the role. Is that what you're suggesting? Sort of like,
yeah.
Of course, if you're ordained and preordained in a strong way, you will offer the prayers, right? if God has really, you know, decided that's how to go. But you're sort of imagining you can either play along with the providential plan or not. So yeah, what if it's true that God has ordained, this is one of the philosophical defenses actually in literature, that it's better for God to do things in response to a request than to do it out of blue. And it could be that God has ordained that certain things will come about only as a result of prayers. So it could very well be that you would be missing out on those things if you only did the thy will be done thing. That's right. That's right. Yes, you're following this perfectly. That's right. Yes. So there's a problem here, and it's the one that's discussed in the literature. So you're tracking that. That's right. Okay. Very good. So,
I'm going to go ahead and have you go. You haven't had a chance yet.
So I have two questions. The first is, what drove you to explore this question, writing this book?
Yeah.
And secondly, what are the things you examine in exploring or trying to search out the answer for this question?
Okay, let me go in reverse order. So as a philosopher, I'm looking at what other philosophers have written about this. I'm looking at the issues that are raised in different fields of philosophy, like what does it mean to have free will? What does it mean to know something? What does it mean to be in control? And those are areas in philosophy that I had already sort of worked on, so it was natural to bring that stuff into this question. And there's not a huge amount of stuff written on petitionary prayer, so the book kind of covers everything that was in there. Personally, what drove me to be interested in this question, this is something I said I wouldn't discuss, but it was more my own struggles with petitionary prayer and trying to figure out how this works for me and how to do it properly and what it, you know, whether I'm, you know, just trying to figure out what's happening. I was part of a group when I was in high school where we kept prayer lists, and if something happened, we would check it off. It was an answer prayer. You know, it was that assumption that when it happens, it's an answer. And we also believed that if something went badly, that maybe Satan was behind it. And when I was studying philosophy at that young age, I started thinking, how do we know that Satan is the cause of a bad thing? You know, because sometimes bad things end up being good things. In the long run, you know, and you sort of wonder maybe God had a reason to permit that. And so then I had the same worry about the prayers that seemed to be answered. Like, if I don't know that Satan is the cause of the bad thing, I don't know if God is the cause of the good thing as a response to a prayer. So that doubt has been in my mind for a long time. And so I still struggle with petitionary prayer. So there was a personal dimension to this too.
Yeah, I think we have time. One more question, I think we have time for.
I can think of lots of examples where we pray for things that are already decided.
Yeah, yeah,
so
right.
I'm getting news in an envelope
right,
about
right, sure.
Test results
sure.
On a, for
right.
cancerous test results. And,
right.
And many of us are in that situation before we even open the
meeting. Yeah.
To pray, let this be a negative result.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like that might actually fall in this category of the illogical things that
yeah.
That we can't actually ask God to do, that accomplish things which.
Yeah,
undo the past.
I think on two out of three accounts of the providence that it does make sense to pray about the past, because God could have known that you were going to pray into the future before He made the decision about the past. So, actually, there's some philosophers who say we should be spending a lot more time now praying for good things that have already happened, because those good things might be depending on our future prayers. Like, we should be praying now that the Allies win World War II. We already know it happened, but maybe it's because God saw that we would pray now that it would happen back then. So maybe that gets out of hand. But I do think I think it's coherent to do what you're talking about. It makes sense. Yeah.
All right. Would you join me in thanking our speaker?
Thank you.
Is this just press the red button?